Welcome to the Collector's Show, where you'll learn insider secrets about collecting everything. Best places to buy, how to judge authenticity, and what are the collectibles of the next generation. Here's your host, Harold Nickel.
Well, greetings and welcome to the Collector's Show. I'm Harold Nickel, happy to be here, and happy to be just about cold-free for the first time in weeks, and I know it'll be a relief to your ears to not have to listen to me honk and snort my way through the program this week for a change. In the interview segment, we're going to be talking about collecting board games with Sarah Reed, and it turns out that, like so many things that we discover here on the Collector's Show, there is so much more to this than anybody would have ever known. Sarah Reed not only collects board games, she invents board games, and I'm going to quiz her about that and many other topics related to board games, like who has time to play a board game anymore? And this is a sad thing to say, but do you know enough people that you could go out and play a board game if your life depended on it? Well, maybe not if your life depended on it, but, you know, the urge comes over you to play Monopoly, and you got to go find three other people to play with. Could you? We'll talk to Sarah about that. And not coincidentally, this is the week that is the anniversary of the invention of Monopoly. In 1935, Monopoly was invented the middle of the Depression, ironically, and still one of the most popular board games of the last in this century. Probably doesn't compete with chess or checkers or Go, which is an Asian board game, but noteworthy nonetheless. And we'll just segue right into the news with that mention of Monopoly. What do Rubik's Cube, little green plastic army men, and soap bubbles all have in common? If you give up, well, they've all been inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame. It's their class for 2014. Now, these three toys beat out a lot of other probably more well-known toys like Fisher-Price's Little People, American Girl Dolls, My Little Pony, and the Hess Oil Truck. And the people at Hess, and it's a good-sized company, pulled out all the stops for getting their truck into the National Toy Hall of Fame. Well, they were beaten by Little Green Army Men and Rubik's Cube and Soap Bubbles. According to the National Toy Hall of Fame, children have been playing with soap bubbles since the 1700s, which I don't really know much about my soap history, but probably the same time soap was invented or discovered. Of course, Rubik's Cube was invented by the Hungarian architect Erno Rubik. Rubik is a guy's name, back in the 70s, but it didn't really get started here until 1980, and I remember having one back in 1980, and man, did I waste time with that thing. Other things that have been previously inducted into the National Toy Hall of Fame: Star Wars action figures. Our friend Brian Simling, who was on with us, will be happy to know that. Hot Wheels, The Game of Life, the Nintendo Game Boy. What are some other ones? Oh, the Atari 2600. Sid Bolton will be excited to hear that, our game collector. The Easy Bake Oven, Candyland, and, of course, G.I. Joe. Lots of others. I'm surprised that the empty cardboard box is not on here. I think every kid, at least when I was growing up, if you had a big cardboard box to play in, buddy, you were set. So, that's really it for the news. Oh, I wanted to mention about last week's program with Daniel Pickett. The website for the Collector Show, collectorshow.net, just blew up after the show was posted and the newsletter press announcement that I do was published, I had double the traffic to the website. So if you missed my interview with Daniel Pickett about Toys R Us' decision to pull the Breaking Bad action figures off of their shelves after one person complained, you can still hear it. It's here on Web Talk Radio, easy to find, and on iTunes. And for that matter, if you get the show on iTunes, you can subscribe, and then every week, as if by magic, a new version of the Collector's Show shows up in your mailbox, queued up and everything, and it's free. So go listen to that if you missed all the hubbub. And now, stay tuned for board games, collecting board games, and maybe just as interesting, who still plays and invents board games, with my guest, Sarah Reed, all coming up next on The Collector's Show. Thanks for being here.
I made $50,000 in the stock market today.
I had twins.
I went to the poor farm.
I'm on Millionaire Acres. That's life.
The game of life. The game of life. You will learn about life when you play the game of life. First you start out with $2,000 and a car.
I got a car.
You got a car. Then you may go straight to college just to get a lot of knowledge.
Harvard.
Or to business if you think you'll go as far.
I'll be a star.
You may go far. Game of life,
the game of life. Pay me, I'll get revenge.
You'll get revenge.
I've got revenge.
You got revenge. Milton Bradley makes the best games in the world. So play the game of life.
That's life.
Well, it's the interview segment of The Collector's Show, and this week we're going to talk about board game collecting, something we've never talked about here on The Collector's Show before. And reading about board games and getting ready to speak to our guest, it seems like board games go all the way back to the Egyptians. There are lots of different types of board games, and there are lots of different clubs associated with collecting different types of board games. And I don't pretend to know much about board games, but lucky for us, our guest on The Collector's Show this week, Sarah Reed, collects board games and I understand even invents board games. Sarah, thanks for making time for us.
Well, thanks for having me on, Harold.
So like I say, I don't pretend to know a whole lot about board games, but I was thinking about the Egyptians and inventing board games, and I guess if you were, you know, stuck in a cave or a hut or an igloo with somebody for months, if not years at a time, and you had to invent something to do, draw lines in the dirt, move a rock around, and bingo, somebody just invented tic-tac-toe, or possibly bingo. Is that how board games started?
Well, in essence, yes. I mean, board games come from play. Play comes from having leisure time and being bored. So if you reverse that, you start with ancient people. Most of their time was filled with survival. But once survival became easier, they started spending some time playing and enjoying life. And then from there, play, once play wasn't enough, then the rules were created to make the play more organized. And that's what led to games and then eventually what we call now tabletop games.
That's an interesting observation, because spending time surviving, gathering food, hunting food, keeping from being made into something else's food,
yeah,
that those things obviously came first, and it was leisure time that started all that. That's so interesting. So I guess with the advent of computer-based game platforms, and so many of them, I guess most of them, aren't really anything more than just a computer that hooks up to the television. A lot of people, me, maybe forgot about board games. Are they still popular?
Well, there's an interesting thing about that, because video games became huge in the early 90s and the early 2000s. Video games really did replace board games as the main entertainment. Mm-hmm. But it also separated people, because then people were playing in their own rooms. Even if you had people hooked up and playing the same game, most of the time they weren't in the same room, let alone the same house. Mm-hmm. And so socializing was reduced. And then, of course, now with mobile devices, socializing is even further reduced. And so there's actually been a rise in getting back to person-to-person interactions. And that is pushing forward board games. It's kind of almost a golden age now, this blossoming of board games back into everybody's thoughts. And it's not just, well, kids anymore. One of the things I think of being so deeply in the hobby is the actor Will Wheaton has been a huge influence, because he does a tabletop, it's called Tabletop, mm-hmm. and it's a show on the Geek & Sundry YouTube channel, and it's been going on for a couple of years, and it's just made it all blow up. I mean, there's families are being brought back together instead of everyone just running off after dinner. They actually stay at the table and play a board game. And it's not just families, you know, friends who they gather together at somebody's house, or even now they go to local restaurants and they play games, or maybe if they have a actual board game store, they'll go there to play. So yes, board games kind of got forgotten, but there's a huge rise in the awareness. It shows up on TV shows like Big Bang Theory. Just the other day, there was a South Park episode that featured modern board games.
No way.
Yes.
On South Park?
On South Park. And I can list almost all the games, which I'll bet you nobody except they're in the hobby, because these are not the Monopoly and Life and those games. It was Dead of Winter, Mice and Mystics, I'm trying to think, Merchants and Marauders, and they're playing Zombicide. And these are some of the main titles of the modern board game hobby. And right now, most of them are not available in your Walmarts and Targets and Toys R Us, but they are starting to show up. Some of the more popular ones, like King of Tokyo, it's a really fun game that just appeals to a lot of people, and it's actually at Target and Walmart and Toys R Us now. So it's starting to blossom from just the, oh, I have to go to a board game store to find any of these games. You can now start going to major mainstream stores to find these, what they call designer games.
Right. I'm probably the only person in all of North America who's never seen The Big Bang Theory.
Actually, you are not alone. I have not seen. I might have seen moments, but I've never actually seen a whole episode.
And one of the main actors on that program, the tall guy, graduated mm-hmm. from the same college that I did, and he's all yeah. over. He graduated from the University of Houston, and he's all over our alumni stuff. But I've never cool. seen it. But yeah. if it's on South Park, it must be cool.
And, oh yeah,
and it's King cool. of Tokyo. Who is that? A somebody? It's not Godzilla, is it?
Well, King of Tokyo is the name of the board game, and it is almost what you would think. There's a bunch of big movie monsters. Each person takes a movie monster, and yeah, well, it's not called King Kong because they don't have the license for it. And life of me, I'm not thinking of what they call it, but there's all these different Godzilla, the King, and there's all these different movie monsters. And you are battling over who is going to be the king of Tokyo. And so there's two ways to win the game. You can either be the last monster standing, so you've killed, or somehow everybody else is dead. Either other people have killed off each other, or you can actually win by victory points. There are certain ways that you can roll the dice to get points, and whoever gets to 20 points first wins. So it can be complete chaos and mayhem, but it can also be a very strategic game, too. And there's cards in there that give you, they are called, I can't think of it, evolution cards that can give you a second head or let you be camouflaged. Or cool. There's all different things like that. And I've had a lot of success introducing that to my family, and they're not gamers. So that's why you're going to see it on Target store and, you know, all the mainstream stores, is it appeals to gamers and what I would call either non-gamers or casual gamers.
It sounds like fun, and I'm intrigued by the by the characters, particularly, you know, giant 10-story tall generic ape, not King Kong. That sounds like fun. But I want to go back to something that you said before about everybody being isolated. And that was one of the things, and I've mentioned this on the show before, that kind of bugs me, that all of this technology and so forth drives us apart. But what I'm hearing you say is that there's kind of a, maybe backlash is too strong of a word, but a trend to that says, hey, we miss being together. Let's play a board game.
Yeah. And it is backlash might be, think of it more as the pendulum swinging back the other way.
There you go.
Because with video games, it was this huge sudden rise in technology. Just technology started evolving so quickly, and so every platform and every game was just better than the last one, and that really gripped everybody into this frenzy of, ooh, this is really cool. But it did start to isolate, even with the multiplayer games. I mean, I remember my high school days, people would actually bring their big computers over, and we'd hook them up, have a LAN party, but because of the way things work, we wouldn't all be in the same room. We'd be lucky maybe two people are in the same room. Somebody's in the living room. Somebody's in someone's bedroom. I mean, I don't think we ever had to set up in the kitchen. But even with this multiplayer aspect, it was still very isolating. It's not the same experience as if you're sitting down face-to-face around a table, which just gives you so much more opportunity to have personal interactions with other people, and, you know, just the instant laughter or whatever that's going on.
And we're social creatures, and I think, you know, there's this book I read several years ago that was called Bowling Alone, and I was so depressed after I finished reading it that we've all become so incredibly isolated. Now you've given me hope, and I appreciate that a great deal. And when I was in high school, we played Risk, and then later in college, the war strategy games, and those were a lot of fun and took hours and hours. Of course, we did it after studying, of course. But
of course.
It gives me hope, like I say. Now, how did you get started collecting board games?
Well, it did help that I had a basis in board games. Like most people, I played games as a kid. My aunt and my grandmother, they played games with me. And I think that really laid the groundwork, because I have noticed a big distinction between those who played games as kids and those who didn't. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that those who didn't will never get into board games, but it is, I think, a little bit harder as an adult to get into it if you didn't play games a lot when you were a kid. So that kind of set me up. And then actually it was high school. I actually started with role-playing games. And whenever we weren't playing a role-playing game, then we played a tabletop game. And so there were a couple things in there. And I continued the hobby lightly into college, but it wasn't until I married Will, and then it's when that hobby really blossomed, and we got really heavily into what I would say actually collecting games. Because up to that point, I'd buy a game, a friend would buy a game, and we had like three choices of games, and that would be it. And then now I have close to 200 choices in games.
Get out of here.
No, it's pretty well. Okay, I do have to admit, about 60 of those board games are actually Lego board games.
That's a lot of games.
Yes, and I do have to admit, we do have a larger collection than most people. Most people that I know, they have more around 30 to 60 games. But even that can seem like a lot to somebody who's not in the hobby.
Or to somebody who has none.
Yeah, there's that too. To somebody who might have Monopoly somewhere in the attic.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah, it's somewhere.
So, that's kind of where we are with it.
That's really neat. And so many of the titles, I mean, everybody's played Monopoly. And I mentioned at the top of the show, in the news segment, that this week is the anniversary of the invention of Monopoly in 1935.
Wow.
And I could probably still play Monopoly, and I could probably still play Risk. Now, you mentioned role-playing games. Now, when I was in college, we played Dungeons & Dragons.
Yep.
And I was terrible at it, and just wasn't going to invest the time to get good. Are there still role-playing games like that?
Yeah. Oh, the role-playing side of tabletop games is huge. D&D is still strong. The other big contender right now is Pathfinder, but then even there's, oh, God, I can't even list them all. Fudge is another big one. Fate, I can't even think of it. Vampire the Masquerade is still around. I mean, there are so many big ones. Plus, there's people every day coming up with their own independent role-playing system. I even have a friend who's going to get started on a game where, I can't remember the name of it, but it's like, tonight we're going to go either slay a dragon or be slain by a dragon. And the rules are 2 pages long. And all you do is you go out, everyone has a role that they play, but it's very simplistic. And yeah, you fight the dragon or you die. I mean,
yeah. And win.
And win.
Yeah.
So it is still really big. And,
well, I saw it on, I don't know if you've seen that. Now, here's a television show I have seen, Community, where they do play role-playing games, and Abed is, I guess, the dungeon master.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they call him the dungeon master, but he calls out the scenarios in the game. So, although the other one is more popular, Big Bang Theory. But anyway, I digress.
Yeah.
We talked a couple of months ago about Ouija boards, and one of the things that came up in that conversation was the art and the graphics. Mm-hmm. Are there any parts of board game collecting that people are drawn to because of the artwork?
There are some. I mean, I think the art or the style, the visual appeal, there's still the people who will collect like Monopoly because there's just so many different IPs or themes to it. But when it comes to the modern board games, more of the collectors that I know are people who follow a particular designer rather than the artist. Because it's one of the things that, yes, a game needs to be very visually appealing, but not as much importance is put on the artist as the designer.
Okay.
So there are people who will follow some of the big name designers. Like they will get every single game that Uwe Rosenberg or Stefan Feld or Rainer Kinesia, any game that they make, and they're some of the most prolific designers out there, and they can come up with 2 or 3 new games a year. People will say, I'm going to get that game. And it's more because of the design or the mechanisms that those designers put into the gameplay that they're drawn to.
Well,
however,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's one design team called Fragger Games, and it's the Fragger Brothers. They make very limited edition runs of their games, and they do make them look amazing. And so that's the only one I can think of that people collect sometimes more for the artwork than the actual gameplay.
I want to come back, and I want to talk more about the Fraggers. But
first,
we're going to take a commercial break. And when it's over, we will be back to wrap up our conversation with Sarah Reed and board games. I'd like to talk to you today about a new app that I've discovered. It's called the Life 360 app. It is described as a family locator, but it is so much more. You'd have to download at least 4 different apps to be able to do everything you can do with Life 360, not the least of which is keeping up with your loved ones. Now, the Life 360 app is available for your iPhone, it's available for your Android, and it's also available on Google Play. And you may wonder, well, you know, what's the big deal? Why do I need Life 360? Everything is fine. Well, maybe not. You don't need me to tell you that life is more complicated and even more dangerous than ever before. Knowing where your family and your friends are, and even where a stolen cell phone might be, are extremely important. What if, for no charge, you could have a little bit more peace of mind? And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. A couple of years ago, we lived in Maryland, and the people I worked for insisted that everybody go to work, in spite of the fact that Hurricane Sandy was tearing through the state. And it worried my wife that I had to be out on the road during a hurricane. And she said, of course, just like everybody always says, call me when you get there. But what if she could have tracked me while I was on my way to work and saved herself all of that worry? Because it wasn't a short drive. It was a good 40, 45 minutes on a good day from where we lived to my office. If she had had the Life 360 app, she could have tracked me the whole way there. She would have seen that, you know, Harold's on the highway, Harold's pulling into the parking lot, Harold's car was blown off the road into a ravine, any of those things, but all of those are way better than not knowing. So spare yourself the grief and the anxiety of not knowing where your loved ones are. Get Life 360 and y'all can keep up with each other. Life 360 is free. It will work on your iPhone. It'll work on your Android phone. I put it on my phone. It's very simple. If you're listening to a podcast, you've got everything you need to be able to take advantage of Life 360. So go to iTunes today, download it, setting it up is easy. If you haven't done so already, subscribe to The Collector Show on iTunes while you're at it. It's also available for your Android, and it's also on Google Play. So go get the Life 360 app today. You'll be happy that you did. And we're back. Welcome back to The Collector Show with me, Harold Nickel, and talking to Sarah Reed this week about collecting board games. And when we left off, you had mentioned the Fragger brothers as designers. Tell us about those guys.
Like a lot of the big names there in Europe, I don't know exactly where, that seems to be where the big names came from to start the modern board game industry. But they are very interesting because they do pretty much their own production, and they do high quality. So one of the most recent ones they did, they had, I'm not sure if it was ceramic, but there was some type of small, resin. They were resin figures of different, like, starfish, and it was called Poseidon's Kingdom.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, so it was a dice-rolling game. And so there were two things that appealed to people about this game is these little resin figures. There was, like, squid and all these other things. But the other thing was the mechanism of how the dice rolled. There was this giant wave. You put the dice on top of the wave, and then you rolled it, and the dice would come off of this wave and roll across the board. And wherever the dice landed is where they were put, and it affected how the game played.
Hmm.
Now, I looked into how the game played. It's a very simplistic game. It'd probably be great for kids.
Mm-hmm.
But it was snagged up by all the collectors for just how awesome it looked.
Wow. That's really something that we create, or collectors create, a shortage of of something because of the designer. When we're off the air, I'll go look these guys up because it sounds intriguing.
Yeah, and they only make, like, limited. I mean, 500 to 1,000 copies of their game, and it's only at the Spiel convention in Essen, Germany.
Wow.
And that's every actually just happened in October. And so every October, I think it's almost every October, they come out with a new game. It may not be every year, but that's where they feature it. And that's where they sell out. And so those ones, I mean, they get caught up by collectors. And then if they do get resold, that's 3 to 4 times what that person paid for it.
Oh, wow. That's really something.
Yeah.
That's like people go to Comic-Con and get the limited editions there and then sell them to pay for their trip. So...
Yeah, it's kind of like that.
The same kind of thing. So let's switch gears here with the time that we have remaining, and let's talk about inventing board games. Tell me how do you invent a board game?
Well, it is a very, very long process. First, you have to have an idea. And there's three main focuses. This is really simplifying it. But there's three ways you can tackle creating a game. Is you can either come at it from a mechanic. There's a certain thing that you want to do mechanically in this game. So, for example, let's say you like dice rolling. Mm-hmm. So you build a game around rolling dice. You can also build things around a theme, such as I want to make a fantasy game, right, or I want to make a sci-fi game. Or you can take it from a player experience. You want to create a certain experience or feeling, so you want to terrify the players. And so you usually start with one of these as your main focus, and you develop your ideas so that you will encompass all three and make, and that's the way you can make the strongest board game, is incorporating all three, so you're not just having a dice rolling game that has no theme and therefore people aren't interested in it because it doesn't connect to them or there's no emotion or feelings in there that gets evoked. So you develop these into notes and you review it until you feel like you're ready to make a prototype. And then you make your first physical version, usually on the cheap. You use index cards and, you know, whatever you have around the house, construction paper and things like that. And you start playtesting, and you playtest, and you playtest some more. And you keep revising as you go through, and you can try to make better prototype versions until you get to a point where you feel like you can do what they call blind playtesting. Mm-hmm. You will actually send or give a copy of your game with the rules to somebody, and you won't be there. So they're going to have to learn how to play the game without you.
Hmm.
So because the end pro- Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a blind study.
Yeah.
And you take your data from that. It's like a double blind focus group.
Mm-hmm.
To use all my big marketing vocabulary.
There you go.
And I'm looking at a list of games because you had mentioned mechanical and want to scare people. There was a game in 1965, Boris Karloff's Monster Game, and I never played that, but it sounds like something that would be potentially scary, or the Twilight Zone game.
Yeah.
So, all right. So you take an idea, a concept, or maybe you want to tie into a movie or a TV show or something from popular culture, mm-hmm, and take it from there. And it sounds like also that unless the players can somehow be invested in the characters or the player, the outcome, that it's not going to be a very good game.
Well, it depends, because the other thing is you do have to design the game for your intended audience. And there are different audiences. There's two extremes to it, and I'll throw out these little terms that are big in the hobby but not for non-gamers, and that's Amerithrash versus Eurogamer.
Mm-hmm.
Amerithrash is dice-chucking, highly thematic, really engaged in the characters.
Okay.
And it's called Amerithrash because most of those games were made in America.
Okay, fair enough. I get that. And the thrashing part is the throwing the dice.
And they're attacking each other. Usually, there are usually some cooperatives, but mostly it's competitive and you're trying to destroy your opponent in one way or another.
Cool.
Now, Eurogames come from Europe, and that's where a lot of the more modern board games started, with Settlers of Catan and Ticket to Ride and a few others. And they're like the antithesis. It's the complete opposite end of the spectrum. There's no dice. There's very little randomness. It's strategy. It's you win or lose based on how well your brain works and the strategies that you can employ. And the most extreme ones are what some people call multiplayer solitaire, mm-hmm, where there's very, very little that you can do to prevent another person from doing something, or very little they can do to interrupt you, except maybe if they take something, like there's a limited resource, they take it, so it's more of a denial, but it's not an outright, I'm attacking you type of thing.
It's passive-aggressive, maybe.
I guess it is a little passive-aggressive there. The next step was to decide whether you try to submit it to an existing publisher or self-publish. And self-publishing has actually become easier because there are print-on-demand board game sites.
Wow.
There's only two ones. One is specifically for card games, but they do it really well. The other one is the GameCrafter.com, mm-hmm, and they actually allow you to build a rather robust board game or card game or dice game, or there's a lot of choices. The quality is not as good as going through the traditional publishing routes. Mm-hmm. So we typically use them for prototyping when we get to that point where, okay, our handmade prototype is trashed and we're solid now, we're going to need a better looking prototype. We go through them. But early last year, we did finish a small set of three micro games. It doesn't have an exact definition, but usually something that's under 20 cards.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a set of three two-player micro games, and we just were at a point where we just wanted to get it done. We didn't want to pay for an artist, so we just put it up on the Game Crafter, and we've sold a few, mostly to friends and family. But now we're planning to go up on Kickstarter, which is the other huge thing that has revolutionized the board game industry, because before you'd either have the Game Crafter or you'd have to go through the traditional publishing route, which is getting harder and harder to get into a publisher because some of them are planned 10 years ahead. They already know what they're going to produce for the next 10 years, so they have no openings for new games.
Well, and they're looking for things that appeal to the masses, not
right.
And you can do like niche games on mm-hmm. On these sites, and Kickstarter
yeah.
is revolutionizing business, period, not just
yeah.
games.
But it has had a huge impact on the board game industry, because now individuals can go on and get their niche game up and be very successful with it, because the big publishers are not going to take the time, but there's a demand. There's an audience out there that wants it. And the trick then is just finding that audience and getting them to Kickstarter. So we're going to be up on Kickstarter at the beginning of next year with one of our games that we've been developing.
Well, I want to ask, with just the couple of minutes we have left about your website, where is it? What's the address? And what will we find when we go there?
Well, if you're talking about, I don't personally have a website, but if you're talking about Board Game Geeks,
that's it.
That is the biggest website to go to look up board games. I wish I could claim that as my own, but I'm a pretty new user of it. So when you go there, it is a huge database of almost all the board games that ever existed. Now, it's a continual process, so as people find that hidden gem that isn't in the database, it gets added.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually look up chess and really, really old ancient games like that, or really obscure ones from the 50s and 60s, or the new modern ones. Or if you want to know, hey, what's going to come out like in 3 months, it's probably already on Board Game Geeks in some form or fashion, because the publishers want people to know about it. The other great thing about that site is the forums. It's a huge community, and there are sub-forums galore on all sorts of different topics, and you can get connected to people in your area that way. There's forums for specific regions of the world. I mean, this is a worldwide website. People will run games through it. They'll do what's called play by forum,
yeah.
And they do that for role-playing, but they also do that for board games, too. So it is just, it's a massive... it's clunky. It's very old. It's such an old site, and it grew so fast that at this point they can't fix it without scrapping it and starting over from scratch. So it's a little difficult to get through at first, but everybody, I'd say most everybody there is very friendly, and there's a forum there for help. I don't know what I'm doing. So, yeah, there's a new user forum. So if you go there and you don't know what's going on, go to the new user forum. If you can figure out how to post, you're good to go, and just ask away.
Yeah, I just called it up. You're right. It says it started in the year 2000, and
mm-hmm.
you know, not to be a big critic, but it looks like what it lacks in aesthetics, it's going to make up for in content. And
oh yeah,
it's big. It's mm-hmm. a lot to wrap your head around. And it says, what does it say here? 66,000 different games, expansions, and designers. That's a bunch.
Yes,
that
it's
is
a lot.
Bunch. Well, Sarah Reed, I really want to thank you for taking time to be on the Collector Show with us this week and introduce us to board game collecting and inventing.
Yes, well, thanks for having me on. It definitely was a lot of fun.
One more word. right after this here on The Collector's Show. Don't go away.
Operation. It's Operation, Milton Bradley's goofy game for dopey doctors. Here's your patient. You take a card.
Remove honey bowl.
Careful, if you touch the sides. You blew it, Charlie. Next.
Take out red stanko.
A winner.
Ha, ha, ha.
Operation, an electric game from Milton Bradley.
I always have fun looking up those old commercials and putting those onto the show. And that Operation game, I think I was actually operated on once by a guy who trained on that game. And boy, did that not end well. And I think, too, from talking to Sarah Reed, we got the answers to the questions that we wanted about board games. Not only are they popular, but sounds like they're having a bit of a resurgence. And the thing that has troubled me and that we talked about a little bit with Sarah and have talked about before here on this program, the isolation that we all suffer from at the hands of technology, it sounds like, and as she said, the pendulum was swinging back the other way, that the days of everybody just playing an electronic game alone by themselves, well, those days will never be over, and people will always want to play computer games, but there's still room for board games, playing them with your family after dinner or your friends and your neighbors. And it also sounds like there's people to play with. If you can find a place near your city or town where they sell those games, I can't imagine they wouldn't be delighted to have you play and likely have leagues and seminars and all kinds of stuff for people to socialize and get reacquainted and out from behind a screen. Next week on The Collector's Show, I promise this time it's Nancy Drew. I've booked the interview. It's Nancy Drew, I promise, and we'll find out once and for all, is it collecting books or clocks or pirate booty? We'll find out next week on The Collector's Show. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, make us your podcast appointment every week here on Web Talk Radio.
Mousetrap, the wildest, funniest game you've ever seen.
Mousetrap!
Catch the mouse, that's half the fun. But there's even more to playing Mousetrap game. Here's where the fun begins. Move two spaces, one, two. Start building the mousetrap. Race your mouse around the board, building a mousetrap as you go. Then comes the funniest part of Mousetrap game. Why don't you get
Mousetrap?
Mousetrap, the nuttiest, funniest game you've ever seen. It's a wonderful game. It's ideal.
The goofiest game you ever saw. Here's how you play Crazy Clock. It's easy. The picture cards tell you how.
I got the broom card.
It's fun to build your crazy clock contraption.
Hey, look! Forget to put in the ladder. Yippee! I've got the crazy clock card.
Good. You get to wind the crazy alarm clock and wake up the little man.
Crazy Clock!
The goofiest game you ever saw.
Crazy Clock!
Crazy Clock! It's a wonderful game. It's ideal.